Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And today, I get to talk with a real maker of monsters. He makes them for real, or as real as your eyes and ears have ever encountered. And I will do my best not to take up too much time gushing over it, but I've had this guest on my wish list for a long time, and I'm a huge fan of his work. And he was generous enough to give me some of his time to talk with me about making monsters, about bringing stories to life, audio. He has two separate amazing careers. Here comes the full introduction of and the conversation with Mr. Edward Emerson French himself. Well, I have the huge honor and pleasure to talk with Edward Emerson French, now from creating bizarre creatures in the TV series Tales from the Dark Side, to his Oscar-nominated makeup designs seen in Star Trek The Undiscovered Country, Star Trek VI, that would be The Undiscovered Country. He can do it all. He's an actor, audiobook narrator, educator, Emmy-winning special effects makeup artist for, let's see, you have the TV show House, HBO's Westworld, nominations for Grey's Anatomy, Mad TV, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Star Trek The Next Generation, I think, as well. The IMDb page for you goes on for miles, and that's not even to mention Clint Eastwood's American Sniper. You've got Teen Wolf, Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, and not even to mention Terminator 2, Terminator Salvation, Dragon Ball Evolution, even that now resurrected as a meme-making phenomenon, Nicolas Cage and Vampire's Kiss. And that's one side of the career. A whole secondary career is this amazing audiobook narration career. And you and Edward E. French's YouTube channel, all the links are going to be in the description of this episode. We've got H.G. Wells, Invisible Man, Time Machine. And we've got on Audible, we've got Edward E. French narrated books on there. And in addition to the love of his fans, like myself, he holds a place of immense respect among the professionals in his field. For instance, Michael Westmore says of him, "Ed French is the epitome of the gentleman makeup artist." That's artist with a capital A. He brings quality, creativity, and a positive attitude anywhere he goes. And now I get to talk with him on The Monster Professor, so he's also an extremely generous man as well. So thank you so much, Edward E. French.
Well, thank you for having me, Professor. I've never been interviewed by a professor before. This is a first.
Yeah, even the professors I know who have lived out in L.A. To get their screenwriting careers going hid the fact that they had been professors because they thought it didn't go very well in L.A. If word gets out, you have a professorly kind of degree.
An intellectual bent, so to speak.
Yeah, perhaps. So I first, a brief story about how I first found you. My wife said, "You've got to listen to this audio narration of Shirley Jackson's The Witch. It's just fantastic." I'm like, okay, I do. And you brought that thing to life in ways that are not easy to do. I've tried audiobook narration, and that's a whole different animal, and it is tough. And this thing came to life, and I thought, isn't this crazy that this Audible or this audio artist has the same name as this fantastic makeup artist as well? And then when it turned out to be the exact same guy, I'm like, I've got to get him on the show. That's immediately wish list.
That's a great story. Thank you. I it's nice to be discovered that way. There's a whole I think we have maybe 9,000 subscribers, not a huge number by some measures of subscribers on YouTube, but to me, that's pretty incredible. You know, I mean, not everybody loves audiobooks, and I don't really go out of my way to promote it too much. It's still like a recreational activity for me. You know, you mentioned all of these credits that I have. That's, you know, 30 years worth of credits, but there's also a lot of downtime when you're not working, and I can't stand being idle. I'm either sculpting something or making something, and then I started to get into making the audios. So there's always something in the works for me. Every day I've got to create something, and the audios are a challenge. And like I say, they're recreational, and I started out as an actor, and a lot of my knowledge about stagecraft and so forth, I think I also brought to the makeup arena too. I understand actors well, and I enjoy working with them, and I enjoy creating characters. That's the main thing with acting and with makeup. If you've got a great script and a good character, there's nothing more exciting or fun to do.
Yeah, and you seem to tend toward both in your audio selections and in your film work, tend toward the science fiction, fantasy, horror. And you've got these great, like, I think daily or very nearly daily updates on your Facebook, account in which you, like, give us a rundown of fantastic horror and sci-fi and throughout history related to the day. And so what first got you, like, where did your love for this come from? And what first got you in that direction of horror, sci-fi, fantasy?
I have a theory that, like most of my colleagues and a lot of people, I was deeply affected by watching movies when I was a child. Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein. I can still recall watching, I don't know whether I saw King Kong first or Son of Kong, but I remember being very, very young and probably in the first grade and seeing this Son of Kong. And made a terrific impression on me. I would go out with my buddies, my little friends, and we would pretend that we were on Skull Island, and King Kong was, Son of Kong was going under the waves, you know, and all, you know, you never forget those first encounters with movies. But I don't know why it affects some people more than others. I know most of my colleagues, it's the same thing, you know. They saw these movies, and they wanted to be. A lot of them, a light bulb went over their heads, I guess, and they wanted to be makeup artists. That came to me later. I saw these movies, and I wanted to somehow be a part of those fantasy worlds. I hate to sound negative, but I just, in a way, I never really got into drugs or you know, drinking heavily. But for me, the theater and movies were just an escape from reality, which I found thuddingly dull and crude.
Yeah, I think to the charge of this genre being mere escapism, J.R.R. Tolkien said something to the effect of, "Who is to say escape is a bad thing? If you escape, when you escape, you're suddenly free from things. So it would only be bad if this is this world is the only interesting thing." I think so. Well, I think it's safe to escape, I think.
I'm pretty down to earth. I pay my taxes, and I'm married. I have two grown children. But if I didn't have my little fantasy escape, I don't think I'd be very happy.
Yeah, and so how in the world did you end up taking that escape and that love into two different careers? I think acting seems to be kind of a bridge between the two, but that still wouldn't necessitate your getting in, having such a career in the makeup world and then having such a fantastic career in the audio world too. So how did that come about, and how do you juggle these two seemingly so different endeavors?
I I won't try to whitewash it or varnish it in any way. I just really didn't make it as an actor. It really wasn't happening. This was over 30 years ago. It wasn't sustaining me, and I was in the right place at the right time when the makeup effects phenomenon, the low budget film, the direct to video films were coming about. This was like 1980, 81. VCRs and MTV started in 82. I was in New York. Back then, you wouldn't find very many people doing special makeup effects. There was a man named Tom Savini who's still around. He was doing these gory horror movies. And I saw a magazine called Fangoria Magazine. Earlier in my life, I used to read Famous Monsters of Filmland. Now there was Fangoria, and I saw these movies were being made, and I thought, gee, that looks like fun. I could do that. You know, the acting thing wasn't happening. And so I honestly am – there were so few people around that I got some breaks. There's a company called Elkhone Company, Paramount Theatrical Supplies. They're still around in New York. And I sculpted some masks, and I put them on display in their showroom. And people started to take my number and call me in to do things. Medical simulations for print ads. First job I ever had was a print ad with somebody with an ulcerated heel, you know, ugly medical simulation that I did out of kit. They were wondering, where's your portfolio? I went in to interview. This is how easy it was. I went in to interview with the ad agency. I didn't realize medical advertising existed. And I went in with some makeup in a paper bag, mind you. And they said, well, where's your portfolio? I said, well, it's out right now. Somebody borrowed it, and I didn't get it back. You know, obvious lie. I'm sure they caught that. And so I said, but I'll show you what I can do it if you show me a picture of it, okay? So they took a magazine out that had this hole in a person's heel. I took off my shoes and socks, and I proceeded to sculpt this wax thing on my Dermawax, mortician's wax, on my heel. And I had a little tomato paste, not blood, tomato paste, mind you, and I put that in, and they went, okay, you're hired. That was it. You know, how much, what's your rate? I had no idea. No idea what you charge for that. I said, well, what do you, you know, what would you charge? What should I charge? I said, $800. Wow. You know, that was a lot of money. I wasn't earning anything in any other place. I was doing part-time jobs. I won't go into that. And, I went in and I did this, and I started to do more of those things. And then word got out, and I was called in by John Caglione, who was doing Amityville 2, and basically got a college course in special makeup effects. He was a protege of Dick Smith, who was a very famous makeup artist, and he had just finished Quest for Fire with Stéphane Dupuy, and they were on this thing, Amityville 2, and they called me in to do the lab work. I learned on the job. I was in charge of making the molds. They'd seen that I'd already made molds. There was nobody else around in those days, and I was, you know, not old, but I was not young either, so I seemed responsible, and That was really the kickoff.
God, I don't even know if that would be conceivable of happening now.
Not at all. I mean, there are plenty of very talented people out there now. I've sworn to secrecy. I'm not supposed to talk about it, but there's a certain TV series that I've helped out on the set of recently, a science fiction series. And don't ask me what it is because I won't tell you. I came in, and they had 50 makeup artists putting on prosthetics, and most of them looked pretty good. There were a lot of talented people. That talent pool did not exist 30 years ago. In fact, if you go back further to Planet of the Apes, the movie, when they did that movie, there was so many prosthetic makeups in it. They literally had to have trained people to set up schools to teach the makeup artists how to do prosthetics. Now people are coming out of the woodwork that do this kind of work. All they need is a little experience to smooth off the rough edges, and they're ready to go.
And I have, by the way, I have a strong guess about what that secret science fiction show project would be.
Oh, don't say it. Don't say it, or they'll call the intergalactic police on both of us. So don't go there, man.
Okay, sure, I won't.
It's one of those things, you know, you try to keep a thing a secret so hard, everybody wants to know and they'll find out, right? The harder you try to make something secret, the less it's more a secret.
Yeah. And you said your understanding of acting and thinking of it from the actor's perspective plays into your makeup. So I was curious if you could let us in on a little bit more about your conceptual process when you have, you know, a makeup challenge or these characters that you have to make come to life, and then you have an idea of who your actor is going to be, like what your creative process is for that, or how you might think about, you know, differentiating between, say, even creatures, like how would your process be different for a Vulcan than an elf, for instance, or even like you get two Klingons, but they have different personalities. So what's your approach for those kinds of challenges, artistically and creatively?
Well, when I was a kid, I never dreamed I would become a makeup artist. I certainly was fascinated by it. And I did a lot of makeup during the years that I worked in theater. I was the young guy who could make himself up to look older or actually bother to do makeup. That's the other thing, too, is a lot of people in theater, they're interested in acting, but nobody was interested in makeup. So I was always sort of hijacked as the guy to help out with makeup. But I do know that when I used to watch television as a young person, I was fascinated by the makeups, the character makeups, where I wasn't sure what they did to change the actor. They did something. I remember Jack Palance in a production of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I could not understand what that subtle change was that Dick Smith created on his face. It wasn't obvious, you know. It wasn't like you looked at it and went, "Oh, he's got a weird forehead, or his nose is ugly, or something like that." Or there was a show called The Wild Wild West where they had a lot of disguises like that. And there was a show called A Man from U.N.C.L.E. where David McCallum went in some disguises. And I was thrilled to see these things. And they all had one thing in common. I couldn't tell what they did to change the person, because the personality still came through. The makeup wasn't distracting. So that's always been, I think, my aesthetic when it comes to designing. Now, recently, I've been doing these Spectrum Monster commercials. I don't know if you've seen them. They're on YouTube.
Yeah, they're great.
That's a good example of the same sort of thing. You see that in The Wizard of Oz, too, the movie, the original movie, the 1939 movie. They did many, many makeup tests. And in the beginning, they were really crude and almost like Halloween makeup. But you realize when you see the movie that you still see these actors underneath coming through. The makeup only enhances their performance. And that's kind of where I go. And in these Spectrum commercials, I'm kind of pleased with the fact that they hired these actors for a reason. They like their personalities. And in a weird way, I try to do as little as I have to, so that when you look at it, you don't go, you know, like, what is it that makes this person look like a werewolf or the Grim Reaper? You know, one of the subtle ones that we do is the Grim Reaper, which is kind of we've changed his bone structure a little bit, but he's not a skull. So the actor comes through and he can be comical as well as a little weird. So I hope that answered your question. I'm not sure where I went with that.
Yeah, and I, that's That's interesting to hear that approach of doing, you know, the minimal required, so you're not getting in the way. Because I have learned some lessons. I'm primarily a fiction writer, and as I'm creating characters, or I'm even working, say, not only with human characters, but even monster characters, I've learned a lot of lessons from makeup, just watching what little I know about the makeup artist world. And that kind of makes sense for a character as well. When you're trying to make a character come alive on the page, it's way too easy to get too heavy-handed with them. You want to get in the way the least amount as possible. You want to make your action in at minimum so you can let the character show who he or she is.
Yeah, you bring me back to the Fiction Fantastique channel too, because those are my favorite kinds of stories. H.P. Lovecraft, I've read a couple of things on there by H.P. Lovecraft, and I became a non-fan. I got halfway through Reanimator, and I thought, I'm not enjoying this, but I'm going to finish it, because it's partly an exercise. And he's famous, and people love him, but I would read anything by Shirley Jackson any day over Lovecraft. Shirley Jackson, you just take the first paragraph of The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, my God.
There's more terror and frightening wordplay in that first paragraph than there is in my opinion. Anything H.P. Lovecraft is, he tries too hard. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, and Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle has to be one of the best books of the 20th century. I mean, it's just absolutely fabulous.
I love her.
Yeah, and so I said that you brought like Shirley Jackson's The Witch to life in ways I didn't expect, and I guess that's not very specific. So to say more specifically, like, it's not that you just brought energy to it, and it's not that you necessarily like tried to do the characters' voices, because I don't necessarily enjoy that when I hear that.
You're totally on the same page with me. I'm still trying to figure out every audiobook. Requires a different approach. I don't think of myself as a mimic. I've heard audiobooks done where the reader really tries to do a voice, and even there's a few that really succeed in doing it. I find it distracting. I think I've broken the rules a little bit. There's some where I'll go, well, you know, I'm going to just go out here and do a voice, but it's not an imitation. It's always me playing the part. That's my approach to it. It takes you out of it if you go too far into something that sounds like a radio play. But that said, I'm on the edge with this Burn Witch Burn that I'm doing now. It's teetering dangerously toward a radio play. It's so tempting because so much of it's dialogue between people, which is what made it appealing to me, you know, to begin with. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were saying something.
No, that's actually you're getting to what I was wanting to know, is more about how your approach and what your kind of do's and don'ts are, because I've tried it. Like, I've given readings at colleges and universities of my work, but that's different because you have a crowd giving you immediate feedback. And I've talked on the podcast, but that's different because it's not really telling a story. And I tried to do my own audiobook, and I just failed miserably. Like, I think it was awful, and it's so hard.
How did you fail? What do you consider a failure?
I think... At some point it started flatlining, and at some point or another, I found myself having just been reading the thing out loud after a few minutes, and I couldn't really strike that balance between telling a story and performance in the way that you do. And maybe that's just lack of experience. It's probably a lot of talent lacking on my end, but I was curious what your tricks were.
I don't know if I could do it live without a lot of rehearsal. What you hear when I do it is, hopefully it doesn't sound like what it is, which is I recorded like you're filming a movie or a TV show. I do a lot of takes, and I don't do this start stop stuff that apparently a lot of the narrators do, where they'll stop and then they'll click the thing so that they can erase what they just did and go back. I just let her roll, and I enjoy the editing process. You know, in essence, I get to rehearse it and then choose the takes that work the best and put them together. So it's not something I've done a few in a studio, and I'd rather work alone and be my own editor. So there are little creations like that. So maybe that's your issue. If you go back and do it, you should just let it roll and then go back and you find as you rehearse it that the understanding of it increases, and then the reading improves. And then there are times when I've done a few takes and I went, well, the first one was fine, you know.
Okay, well, that's my next project then. I'm going to get back on it and try the Edward E. French system.
I think so. I think the thing you're trying to do, and the thing that turned you off, was you felt like you were just reading it. You really do have it. The hard work is to make it sound like you're telling a story to somebody. I think you have to visualize that. To me, it's like this is your this is your old grandfather telling you a bedtime story or something like that. It definitely have to have an audience in mind.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why it's so much easier live, I think, in front of a crowd or an auditorium for me, than because if you're getting boring because they're starting to nod, and you know if they're excited because you can see it and hear it. And I think
No, it's great. I sometimes think, gee, at some point I'd like to do a reading maybe on YouTube, literally, like, you know, I'm sitting here in front of you in front of the camera. That might be interesting.
Yeah, that would be cool. So this isn't much of a segue, but I've got to know a little bit about your makeup designs. I've always been fascinated with how much you blend the fantasy ideas and the high concepts of things that don't exist with actual anatomy, zoology, biology, even robotics. And so I'm curious how much the rules and the structure and what you've learned, say, or picked up from anatomy, how much of that plays into your makeup designs, or in what way that plays into it.
Anatomy is important, but it depends on the on the character. Certainly everybody knows what a bald head looks like, so you strive for realism there. What does the Grim Reaper look like? Well, like I was saying, he has a different skull-like bone structure, but we try to keep it within the realm where it's not distracting, but it makes a kind of aesthetic sense. It fits the face. Hair work is terrifically important. We do a lot of that on the Spectrum commercials with the werewolves particularly. So
the hair work seems immensely difficult or tedious or something. I'm not quite sure. That seems like it'd be really...
It is difficult, and I think we've actually upped our game. We just recently did some new ones, and when they come out, I think you'll see. I'm very happy with the way the werewolf looks. In fact, I'll probably put it on the Facebook page soon. I haven't had a chance, and you can see how it's changed. I like Mrs. Werewolf. She has a certain style to her, and there's a kind of a storybook quality that I like about it. You want to know it's a werewolf, but it's a cartoon too. And at the same time, it has to look plausible in terms of the prosthetics and the way the hair appears to be growing. So I've gotten him to match her more, or, you know, match that sort of coiffed look. We're going for monsters, but They're monsters that have to be relatable.
Yeah, in the face does that happen? Like the eye, is it around the eyes, the mouth, or is it like a zoom out, just the overall kind of picture and judgment of it? How does your brain work artistically that way?
I don't know. Like I say, it's like back when I was working as an actor, I was in a production of Richard III playing the title role, believe it or not, and I was doing the Richard III limp, and the director said, no. It's terrible. I said, well, what would I do? He's limping. You know, he's got a deformed foot. He said, no. If you had a deformed foot, would you be acting like you had a deformed foot? Wouldn't you want to be hiding it a little bit, you know, like trying to walk normally? And I thought about that, and I went, yeah, you're right. You know, it's like, it's the same with the monsters, and the same with, again, when we get back to Shirley Jackson and her effects, it's you try not to make a thing grotesque or gross or ugly. You work against that, and sometimes when you make something kind of beautiful that's a monster, it's much more amazing. So I guess that's, again, the only way I can analyze it.
Yeah, that's some brilliance for monster making, and I think even character making right there.
I never forgot that, and I think at some point I also read somewhere that I can't remember which actor said it, but he said, you know, they said, well, how do you like playing the villain? They went, no, I don't play the villain. I'm playing the hero. I think it was Joseph Wiseman who was playing Dr. No. said, you don't play the villain like a villain. He thinks he's the hero. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to, and maybe that's a part of your makeup strengths too, seeing it from the side of the person you're working on, seeing it. If you're writing a character, seeing the world from that character's eyes. If you're doing a makeup, see it from the actor's eyes.
Yeah. We also, I'm boasting a bit, but we made a lot of teeth for these monsters too. And, they had to be able to speak while wearing these teeth that, you know, so they worked very well. They had to do a little bit of work and rehearsing to speak. At the same time, they have these monstrous teeth, which, again, they're not in your face, so to speak. I mean, every once in a while, they'll smile or stop and pause and you'll notice it. And I love that kind of thing. It's not like, you know, obvious.
And hair and teeth are the things that I think I see that are the signs of cracks in the makeup among, say, less experienced makeup artists than yourself. And so,
yeah, it's a vital skill. And it's interesting. I go online on Facebook and I see a lot of amateurs and beginners posting pictures of work, and most of it's gory, you know, or it's accident makeup, or they try to do a makeup and it kind of falls short in, particularly in the hairdressing department. Those are two very important skills. I mean, you have to understand color, prosthetics, and hair work. It can really sell, an illusion, that hair. But, I look at some of the work and I cringe, and then I go, well, you know what? This is great that a person's doing this and they're not, like, you know, making pipe bombs or something.
Yeah,
you know, it's good for you. You know, do a monster makeup. Do a thing where you pretended you're you've got the slash across your face. Have fun. But that's that gets a good reaction and people enjoy it. But it's quite a craft. You never stop learning.
And I like that approach to it too, because I'm not sure if there's a running theme on this show, but it seems to be something to the effect of that monsters are important for us, and not just in storytelling, but for us. And like you said, if you're busy making monsters, then maybe some part of you doesn't need to actually become one so much. Right. And if you know a lot about monsters, maybe you can know a little bit more about them in the real world.
Well, they tell us a lot about ourselves. Let's face it, the original Frankenstein, the novel itself, you know, is a reflection of, you know, the mystery that we live in, this existence, and, you know, some of the loneliness. All the monsters on some level are usually more human than the humans in the dramas.
Yeah, and if I may hit you with the simplest but the toughest question of all that I love to ask my guests.
Oh, no.
What is your favorite monster of all time? And I'm asking, by the way, just to remind my listeners, I am asking the maker of monsters himself. He makes them for sight on screen. He makes them come to life on audio. And the listeners can't see, but I see monsters in the background. And so no pressure, but big question, favorite monster of all time.
I've never been asked that question. I think it's the Frankenstein monster, though. There's so many iterations of the Frankenstein monster. It goes through literature and movies. The outsider, the person or creature who really is trying to find out who they are and how they belong in the world. It's a very relatable monster. That's probably why it's the earliest monster we remember and we relate to is Frankenstein. It's really kind of a triumvirate of monsters that are, I would say Frankenstein, yes, the favorite, but there are three that almost go together as a trio, and that would be the Frankenstein monster and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Dracula. These are monsters that have a lot in common.
Yeah, those three in particular seem to have a life of their own beyond their works, I think. I mean, when you read the novels, Jekyll and Hyde, Frankenstein, Dracula, you get an extremely different impression than what I was used to seeing in the Universal Pictures versions. Like my version of the Frankenstein monster was a lot closer to, like, you know, the in Prometheus, the giant white kind of marble figured human beings and it perfectly sculpted. And that's nothing like, you know, the James Whale Frankenstein creature, but that one is just as amazing in a different way. And so they've kind of like been absorbed into the general mythology of the culture as these things that can keep showing up in different ways. So they're even deeper and more archetypical in that way. Dracula the same, Jekyll and Hyde the same, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not a great literary critic. I've read a lot of literary criticism. People have just, you know, ragged on the writing of some of these things, but there's no denying their staying power. They continue to come back and people continue to read them because there's something there.
Yeah, and I think in those three in particular, you have something like in the Jekyll Hyde, you have something about at any moment your own light side can switch to the dark side, I think. I think you have something in Dracula of that greed and thirst maybe that we all have, or potentially anyway. And then that Frankenstein character, you have something of, you know, your need for human connection, and once you become the outsider, how far dark that presses you. And between those three, those cover a lot of our real problems in life, I think.
Yeah, this fiction, each one of them reveals something about what it is to be human, which you just reminded me, of course, the Island of Dr. Moreau is another one.
Oh, yeah.
Where he goes right to it. Like, you know, what's the difference between man and beast?
Well, I tell you what, You've been extremely generous with your time, and I think I've pushed you back beyond what I promised I wouldn't necessarily push you to, and I know you're an extremely busy man.
I haven't noticed it. How long have we been talking?
At least 40 minutes.
Well, I hope it was interesting. Even if you have any other questions, let me know. I'll try to answer.
Well, if you're okay, if you're going to extend the invitation, I'll just hold you for maybe a few more minutes. Because I was kind of curious about your audio projects and then your film projects. In both of those categories, I was curious if you had a particular favorite, like a favorite film project you've worked on. And it sounds already like for the audio project, Shirley Jackson. But I don't know if that's your answer for sure. So favorite film project and favorite audio project?
Hard to have a favorite film project. I mean, the high point of my career was 2 decades ago when I did Star Trek VI. That was a thrill. I grew up watching the original series, and I couldn't believe I was on the set with, you know, the last movie with the original cast from Star Trek. Shatner and DeForest Kelly and all of them were there.
Yeah, and that one seemed to have the heart of the original TV show, perhaps more than any of the other movies in my mind, I think.
Yeah, I think it did, but I got to confess, as much as I'm prejudiced, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, is brilliant.
Yeah, that's good.
Great, that's a great movie, great protagonist, antagonist, and great plot and a lot of fun too. But, Star Trek VI was very special and an unforgettable experience. And to be nominated for an Oscar was beyond belief. Here you are getting nominated for, essentially what was a TV series. So it really was an honor. Now, as far as a literary reading goes, it's weird. There's certain books when you get into them that really get to you. And I like The Fly. That's I broke my little rule about trying to do impressions. I can do a fairly good Vincent Price. And I actually did pretty much, you know, without getting too fancy about it, I kind of tried to do it a little like Vincent Price. It's just a wonderfully written story, and it's heartbreaking too, and the characters, the dialogue is just brilliant. I mean, it's not realistic dialogue, but it seems like real people talking to each other, and it's quite intense, and the ending is really beautiful. So that's probably my favorite. I think that went down well.
Well, that's next on my list then, because that's one I haven't listened to. I've listened to, I think, all of your H.G. Wells, even your Charles Dickens stuff, The Great God Pan, Shirley Jackson, but I don't think I've gotten to that one yet. So that's next. And by the way, for our listeners, once again, I've got links in the description of this episode, where whichever platform you find it on, to Edward E. French's YouTube and channel and his website as well. But if you haven't already, you've got to subscribe, because this is fantastic stuff he's putting out there. And you just have access to it just like that easily on YouTube. It's fantastic.
It's great. Yeah, it's free as the wind. And I'm the windbag telling the stories.
Far from it, sir. Far from it. Well, thank you again so much for talking with me. It's been a huge honor and a huge pleasure that you were so generous with your time and getting to talk with me about monsters and the dark side of literature.
Well, thank you for having me. It was interesting, and I hope we'll do it again sometime.